Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning former New York Times reporter and Emmy-winning producer-correspondent, about the Democracy Rebellion, his PBS documentary on grassroots movements who are winning political reform victories state by state. And you can learn more at reclaimtheamericandream.org. I'm going to say that again. It's one long word, reclaimtheamericandream.org. And you can also go there and look under videos and then look under PBS air dates to find out when the Democracy Rebellion is going to air on your local PBS station in your neighborhood. Okay? After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land, The Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, Terrence McNally, one word, TerrenceMcNally.net. Quick plug for participation. Every show, I spell out a few websites that I think are helpful if you want to be more engaged. Indivisible.us, also just about every, Indivisible dot, almost anything gets you to Indivisible. And that's a organization with about 5,000 local chapters that will send you an email every week telling you things you can do to be involved in political participation. A couple that are digital but work closely with the grassroots on a national level, moveon.org. That's one word, moveon.org. And Courage Campaign, one word, couragecampaign.org in the state of California. A couple that are very specific to meeting and talking with your representatives, fivecalls.org. That's the number five and the word calls. Fivecalls.org tells you what are the most relevant and timely calls you might make to your representatives. And Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com, which tells you when your representatives are going to be holding public meetings at home, and you can go and speak to them person to person. To today's guest, and some good news. Buried beneath all the headlines, tweets, and cable news clashes about D.C. gridlock or dark money or Trump outrages and impeachment, how many of you know that 2018 was the best year for political reform since the 1960s, and that new reforms are already having real-world impact? Connecticut's public funding of campaigns has transformed state politics, changing who can afford to run, putting more women and minorities in office, lessening lobbyist influence in the legislature. California has a crackdown to expose dark money, these disclosure acts. They disclose the dark money funding networks that provide the funding for initiatives and ballot propositions, and this provides a model for other states to follow. Florida's path-breaking gerrymander reform, voted in by a huge supermajority, which shocked the power elite and caught lawmakers secretly violating the law. To get a deeper look at this movement, tune in as PBS stations all over the country air The Democracy Rebellion, in which today's guest, Hedrick Smith, takes you into six states where citizens are actively reclaiming democracy. Hedrick Smith spent 26 years as a reporter, editor, and bureau chief at the New York Times, serving in Saigon, Cairo, Paris, the American South, and as bureau chief in Moscow and Washington. In 1971, he was a member of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team for the Pentagon Papers series. And in 1974, he won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for his reporting from Russia in Eastern Europe. His book, The Russians, was a number one American bestseller, translated into 16 languages. His four other books, including Who Stole the American Dream in 2012, were bestsellers. He has created 26 primetime specials and miniseries for PBS since 1989, including Is Walmart Good for America?, The Wall Street Fix?, Can You Afford to Retire?, Rediscovering Dave Brubeck. By the way, I interviewed Smith on the book Who Stole the American Dream in 2012, and you can find and listen to that interview on my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, and on the many podcast sites where my episodes play. Welcome again, Hedrick Smith, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Friday, January 3rd.
Terrence, it's great to be with you again. I enjoyed the first round. I'm sure this will be a good conversation.
Great. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. And you have if I'm not mistaken, I count 26 years in newspapers and then 40 plus years as an author and in television.
That's a little bit much, but it's getting close to 60 years total.
That's what I'm thinking.
I've been doing this a long time.
I want you to do a couple of things in this answer. One, trace that path a little bit for listeners so they can get a little more background on you. And then that last thing that you were about to say, which is what keeps you going? But those two.
Yeah, well, I began actually in high school working for my hometown newspaper in the summer in Greenville, South Carolina. I came back after my senior year in college and worked there again. Then I went off and served in the Air Force. And then when I got done with that, graduate school at Oxford and then the Air Force, I then joined United Press International in the South, in Memphis, Tennessee, Nashville, Atlanta, and then got hired by the New York Times. But the UPI experience in the 1960s was very important because I was in Nashville in February 1960 when the modern civil rights movement began. I met John Lewis there, covered Martin Luther King in Birmingham long before the March on Washington, but I was also at the March on Washington. You know, and then Saigon, Cairo, Paris, Moscow, as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. Several times people tried to hire me to go work in the world of television, and I couldn't figure out how I was going to tell a story in 130 words when the Times would give me 1,000. But eventually I decided to try it after I'd gotten into book writing, and I converted the book that I wrote called The Power Game, How Washington Works, into a television series, and that changed my life and got me into television production. I set up my own company. You said 26 productions. That's right. That's in my bio, but it turns out this new one, The Democracy Rebellion, should make it 27.
Very
so I need
good.
To update the bio.
Yep.
And that was a huge change. I loved being a foreign correspondent, roaming on my own, deciding what the stories were. You know, I was 5,000 miles, 10,000 miles from my editors.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have much control over me, and I loved the freedom, and I loved that life, and had a very, very interesting experience, particularly in Moscow. And I wrote one book out of that, and then later on went back as a television correspondent, wrote another book on Perestroika and Gorbachev. So the range of activity has just been wonderful for me. And I think that's part of the answer to your question.
Right.
How do I keep going? The answer is discovery, curiosity, learning is just an enormous energizer for growth. There's always some story, some situation, something I'm interested in finding out. And I believe without intending that to keep me young, at least in my mind, I think that's been the case. When I went back to my 25th and then particularly my 50th college reunion, I could tell that with very few exceptions, I had a lot more energy left and a lot more drive left to keep living as opposed to getting in a golf cart and chasing a white ball or sitting on a beach under an umbrella or going on cruise lines, all of which things I might do, but I couldn't see doing them full time. And I really honestly believe that it was journalism and the practice and the constant need to look beyond whatever horizon I could see to go discover something new. That's keeping me going today at age 86.
Yeah.
And that's why I got a new documentary. Now, do I plan to do 5 more documentaries? I don't think so, but but I do have a couple of other ideas. And I just wrote an op-ed on Russia and the new nuclear arms race. So the mind is still active, and I think the journalism is part of what makes it work.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, it's been, I was surprised to realize it was 7 years since the interview on Who Stole the American Dream. And then I know we ran into each other in the intervening years at the Conference on World Affairs, but I am always, as I look around me and see others become, you know, less active, less engaged as the years wear on. I think of folks like you and Norman Lear and folks like that that just keep trucking.
Well, you know, one has to acknowledge something, that we're just plumb lucky. I mean, we, you know, this, some of this is just DNA and it's a matter of chance. So, I mean, I understand that. But I do feel that even, I mean, I've run into people who've been very successful lawyers and some successful businessmen. And a lot of people I know in Washington at age 55, which is not a dying age, of course, are bored stiff by the very lucrative and successful jobs they're doing, and they're aching for something that's really intriguing and inviting. And I have never felt that problem being a reporter, being a journalist. I think staying a reporter has been important. I got into management at one point, and I didn't like that anywhere near as well as I liked the reporting. When I ran my own firm making television production, I had to manage, but I was also still reporting and editing and doing the creative work. And to me, that's really essential to fun, to the enjoyment of life, and it's also the way my curiosity plays out. I'm interested in how systems work, how countries work. I'm much less interested in just the daily breaking news, although I did that for a long time.
No, I understand that. Right. There's daily events, and then there's the arc, sort of that these things fit into, that you take a step back and you see, where are we going and how can we affect it? I mentioned the 2012 book.
Or how did we get here?
Well, I mean, I have this one format that I use sometimes. If it's broken, in this case, let's say democracy, how did it get broken? What's the evidence that it is? How did it happen? And how do we fix it? You know, it's like those are the questions. And I mentioned the 2012 book, Who Stole the American Dream? And I believe that in some ways, some of the stimulus for this documentary and the research you've been doing on folks who are fighting to restore and reform democracy come out of that
and
book.
What happened, Terrence, was that after I wrote that book, Who Stole the American Dream, which was my own effort to discover for myself, how do we get the terrible economic inequalities that we have, and how are they structurally built in terms of home ownership and retirement costs, and not just wages and profits, although that's in it too. And going around the country giving talks about that book and that problem on college campuses, to civic groups, to all kinds of organizations, I kept getting peppered with questions from people saying, what are we going to do about it? And I also talked about the kind of dysfunctional political system we had fallen into, and they were asking about that. So I began to explore that myself. What are we doing about it? Who's working on it? Where is it happening? So that I could answer the questions of the audiences. And then I needed a repository of the information that I was beginning to collect. So I created the website, ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org, that you just mentioned. And it's loaded with information. And it was the springboard into the documentary. So you're absolutely right. There's a direct connection between my last book in this documentary, even though it took 6 or 7 years to get from one to the next.
Yep. And that website, I do want to talk just another minute about that, because as you say, it is not a static website by any means, and it is not just go there and see what Hedrick wrote lately. It's very much an interactive website offering tools, telling you if this is the issue you care about, learn this, and here's who's working on it, etc. If you want to talk just any more about what you are most proud of in terms of that website.
Well, it's a cafeteria. It's an intellectual cafeteria. I've taken several issues, public funding of campaigns, exposing dark money, voters' rights, Citizens United, but also some economic issues like student debt, like minimum wage, like what I call sharing capitalism, where are there companies that are actually doing innovative work, but they're also sharing more of the wealth. And what I did was I set up what I call an issue brief. What's the issue? How did it become an issue? And then there's a progress report, and it's literally a state-by-state rundown of what people are doing in different states on these different issues. And then what I call a success story, you know, is who's tackled the issue and come out on the other side with a solution. And then what readings would you read? And then what organizations, as you said, what organizations are you working on this issue? So that if, and we even have what we call a toolbox. You can click on a toolbox, and then you can go get whatever it is you want on whatever issue, of, at least the ones that I cover, wherever you want to go. And, you know, what I've done is stayed a journalist and used the experience of the New York Times and making these 27 documentaries or miniseries for PBS, just using that those techniques to put it out there for people to use as they wish. Obviously, I think these are issues that are important that should be taken care of, but I'm not trying to advocate for one solution or another, but I do think that we need in the media to go beyond focusing on problems. And we are watchdogs. It is part of our responsibility to hold power accountable, whether it's economic power or whether it's political power or social power, to hold it accountable. And we do need to focus on problems and point them out. But I think people mistrust the press in part because we spend so little time telling stories about what people are doing to solve problems. There's a new organization that I learned about in the course of this documentary called Solutions Journalism Network. And their whole commitment is to try to get more media time and effort focused on how people are working on solutions and what kinds of solutions work. Now, I'm not just talking about profitable businesses. I mean, Business News covers that, but I'm talking about social and political issues. There's a tendency for us to focus on what's wrong without saying, is anybody doing anything about what's right, and is any of the stuff that they're doing working? And that began to interest me, I would say, 15, 20 years ago, not just with this documentary, but I did a series for PBS called Challenge to America. I have 4 hours. And at that point in the late 80s and early 90s, we were feeling a lot of pressure from Asia, from the Japanese in particular, but also the Europeans. And I was interested there, not just in what the problems were and what they were doing overseas, but were there people in America who were figuring out how to make our education better, how to make corporations run better, how to share the wealth better? And there are. And so that element, which is obviously a major part of the democracy rebellion, it's about solutions. It's about people taking action to tackle the problems that are frustrating, 70, 80, 90% of the American public, at least according to opinion polls. So that idea of dealing with solutions or efforts at finding solutions has been part of my reporting and my television production work and my book writing, for at least 10, 15 years. And as you know from Who Stole the American Dream, there's a good bit of that in the last couple of chapters of that book.
Yeah. Now, and I would just say this is your that that orientation is one I share from the very start. And I've been doing this since 96. Hard to believe. I say this is about a world that just might work. It's the people who are, right? It's the I'm looking at the problems, but I'm always looking at who's doing something that might get us out of this, and always looking for the solution. I hate to go through an hour and not get into some of how are we fixing this and how are we gonna fix it. And watching the Democracy Rebellion, I found myself cheering your heroes on. One thing you do is you choose these six states. Each one dealing with a different problem, but you zero in on usually a couple of individuals so that we also get not just the, again, like I said at the start of the show, it's not just the ideas, it's not just the reforms, it's not just the efforts, but it's the human beings who are making this happen and what makes them, what drives them. And I found myself cheering these heroes on, and it was funny. At times I would go, yes, you know, and I'd find myself feeling optimistic. And was that unfounded?
No, it's not. It's not unfounded, but what it is, it's a wonderful discovery. I mean, because, and I have to say that's even true for me as a reporter. When I went around the country making these talks and I was starting to look into this stuff, what I was hearing and reading from my colleagues based in Washington, the Washington Press Corps, reading public opinion polls and listening to the politicians was, And talking to people is we've got a broken political system. Elected officials don't listen to people like me. Lobbyists have too much power. Corporations have bought Congress. Elections are rigged. I mean, you heard that from both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders back in 2016 and lots of other people since then. You know, basically, I was hearing a very negative picture. And I had a sense also that American capitalism was in trouble, even though lots of profits were being made and Wall Street was booming. Ordinary Americans were really suffering. They couldn't afford a really good education for their kids. They couldn't afford their own retirement. They couldn't afford their health care. So there were a lot of negatives. So to go out in the country and discover people like Cindy Black and Linda Bach out in Seattle,
yep,
working on a citizens movement to roll back Citizens United, objecting to the enormous Niagara of money in political campaigns and saying, we got to come off the sidelines. We got to do something about it. The politicians aren't doing it. Or people like Ellen Friedan in Florida, a very savvy attorney, but somebody who'd not really worked on political campaigns too much. She'd done some, but not much. She wasn't a professional. Putting together an unbelievable gerrymander reform movement across party lines, drawing in blacks, drawing in Latinos, obviously getting a lot of support from the Anglo community. I mean, seeing people like that was really inspiring to me. I mean, I was amazed, and you mentioned in your intro to the program the impact of the public funding of campaigns in Connecticut. It's changed the landscape of the state. I couldn't believe it when I got there. I mean, I've been around doing this reporting a long time. I've been around politics a long time. I've covered a bunch of presidential campaigns. I've covered six presidencies. I was surprised, and I'm immensely encouraged by what I've seen at the grassroots. I think part of our problem in America today, and certainly a big part of our problem in the media, is we're way too Washington-focused. I don't mean just on Trump, pro and con, which is certainly the center of our focus at the moment. But it's been very Washington-focused even during the Obama years and during the George W. Bush years and during the Bill Clinton years. And a lot of the good stuff in this country and this country's history has started out in the states. That's where the progressive movement started a century ago that led to women's right to vote and direct election of senators and a whole bunch of other reforms. And then the civil rights movement, you know, began in places like Nashville and Montgomery, Alabama, and Greensboro, North Carolina, places like that. So I think going out to the country and finding the strength there is a natural thing to do. And like you, I was impressed with the people I saw, impressed with their with how deeply they care and how they found a way to channel their anger. A lot of them were very angry. And it's easy to be angry and sit at the 19th hole or sit at your bar or sit around your table and bitch about what's wrong. And there's a lot of that going on in this country. But these people said, no, we got to do something about it. What are you going to do with your anger? Well, I'm going to go out there and we're going to find something to change. And my God, they did it. And it's amazing. It's yeah. amazing to see how broad it is.
Yeah. Now, one thing, I mean, you said that when you went out after the book, Who Stole the American Dream, and were speaking to Americans in person in groups, and they were saying, what can I do? I think that question, I think, has been around for a while, and I think got very much heightened by Trump's election. But that, I think there is, you know, among Americans, that question, what can I do, seems to be such a paramount one, and that's exactly what your work and this documentary is speaking to. You covered civil rights movements in the 60s when they were happening, when it was bristling. You covered, you know, anti-war. It seems to me that there was a time when the protests, the demonstrations, the mass movements were just a featured story. They were, you know, there were other things going on, but they were like one of the threads. I feel like that's not so true now.
No question.
How similar do you find what's happening now, even if it's not being covered to that extent?
Well, let's talk about the coverage for a moment, and then let's do the other, because I think there are a lot of similarities in the movements, but the coverage is enormously different. If we go back to the 60s during the Civil Rights Movement, American electronic news, at least the electronic news, was dominated by the three networks.
Yep.
Most people tuned into the same news every night. one way or another. And that meant that people got some kind of the same picture of reality. That's number one. And today the media is fractured, and I don't mean just left and right, but it's just broken up. Nobody has anywhere near the dominance of the audience, okay? So there is no kind of national picture. The second thing is, that was an era of considerable idealism. When you think about protests, there's a tendency to focus on either anger or violence, but the truth of the matter is if people protest, they actually believe that if they protest, something can change. It's a very idealistic thing to do. It's a very hopeful thing to do, whether you're looking at Hong Kong today or you're looking at the democracy rebellion in America that I'm reporting on. And I think that was a very optimistic era, and I think the media was optimistic. I think today the media is very cynical.
Mm-hmm.
I think the media is very cynical about hyper-partisanship, about the inability of ordinary people or popular movements to make any change. If there's a demonstration, if there's a women's march on the day after Trump is elected, it gets a massive coverage of the event. If there's a Parkland, Florida high school shooting and the kids protest, they cover the event. But it's covered as an episode. It's not covered as something deeper and continuing. And if it's not dramatic and not powerful, and if it doesn't create really powerful images, then it doesn't get much coverage, and it's not treated as being very important. And I think the cynicism of the media, also the shrinking of the media. Understand that the dollars and cents are much less. The media is much less profitable, so you don't have extra staff. If you want to do the kind of work that I'm doing, I worked on this for 3, 4, 5 years.
Right.
Okay, that takes a lot of commitment of time and money, and most news organizations find it a heck of a lot more profitable to cover Trump's tweets, because that's really easy. It doesn't take much time at all to cover that. It's like covering a fire in your local news. All you got to do is have a police radio, listen to when there's a fire, chase the fire truck, put the camera on it, and then go put the pictures on the air, and then people say, wow, they're really covering the news. Well, maybe they're not. Maybe the real news is the building code is no good, or that there was a bad landlord, or that something is sloppy, or there are electrical appliances that are exploding, or whatever. But that takes a lot of digging, a lot of effort. And if you got tight budgets, you don't do it. So I think the biggest change in some ways between the 60s and today in terms of the impact of and the knowledge about grassroots protest movements is that the media has changed. The movements in some ways are similar, not necessarily the same groups of people. In the civil rights movement, obviously it was blacks. It was particularly blacks in the South, in Montgomery, Alabama, or Birmingham, or Nashville, or Greensboro, or Jackson, Mississippi, or St. Augustine, Florida, whatever it was, protesting. Joined by whites. And what's interesting today is if you have voter rights protests in North Carolina really fighting against legislation that's targeted against minority voters, most of the people that get arrested are the whites for protesting. So there's a lot of sympathy across racial lines there. But the coverage tends to be very local. The North Carolina story stays in North Carolina. The Connecticut reform story stays in Connecticut.
Yep.
The Seattle, Washington State story stays there. The California story is not terribly well known elsewhere. People are not, and the media are not, they neither have the knowledge nor the imagination to understand that there is a movement afoot here to try to fix democracy, and it's occurring from the bottom up. And what's going on, I think, is that ordinary Americans are both angry and frustrated and therefore active, but they also have begun to understand that if you want to get to dealing with climate change, you want to get to dealing with gun violence, and if you want to get to dealing with immigration, or you want to get to dealing with health care, the gateway issue is fixing our democracy. The gateway issue is making elections fair, giving more people the chance to vote, stopping politicians from rigging elections by manipulating the district maps through what is called gerrymandering, through the movement of dark money, through the concentration of donors. All those people, enough people, it may only be 5, 7, 8, 10% of the public, but enough people and enough states have begun to understand that if we're going to get back to a functioning democracy on substantive issues, we've got to fix the way our elections and our election campaigns work, because at the moment, the deck is stacked in favor of very wealthy, very powerful, very entrenched special interests.
Yeah.
That's really important. That change, the fact that people have awakened to that and decided they must do something about that, is a phenomenal story. As a reporter, I love that story. It's a great story, and it's a story that is vastly, vastly, vastly undercovered.
Very much so. Let me just read. There's a quote very close to the end. It's in the last minute of your documentary, in which someone, and I forgot who it was exactly, but this is the line he says: "We are seeing activism the like of which we haven't seen in decades," echoing what you just said. "There is enormous opportunity to move reform today because people are hungry for concrete action they can take at this moment." And I think that speaks to exactly what you're saying, that because of the anger, because of the frustration, because of this question, what can I do, it is a very it's actually a very positive moment for action. Let me tell people that this is Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning former New York Times reporter, Emmy-winning producer and correspondent, about the Democracy Rebellion, his PBS documentary on grassroots movements who are winning political reform victories state by state. And you can learn more and find when the program will air on the PBS stations in your area at his website, reclaimtheamericandream.org. Reclaimtheamericandream.org. And if you look there, you can see a drop down for videos, and then you can go to PBS air dates and find out when it's playing.
Yeah, that's key. It's reclaimtheamericandream.org. Terrence, if I can just add.
Yeah.
On the toolbar at the top, you'll see a bunch of things: issue briefs, progress reports, and so forth. Then you'll see videos. Just hover over the videos. There'll be a drop down. It says PBS air dates. If you go to the PBS air dates, you can find out where the Democracy Rebellion is playing. It starts showing, January 6th in a bunch of cities, and then it rolls across the country all through January and into February and probably hopefully beyond. But at the moment, certainly all of January and into February and all across the country. And in your home city of
Los Angeles,
it's on your local station, KOCE, on January 13th. So I hope people will find it there. And then it comes up again on January 17th and so forth. So look, please.
Yeah. And one reason we're saying this is that unlike some of the networks, PBS will maybe at the end, almost all the stations will show a program, but they won't necessarily show it at the same time. So there isn't just this one, Tuesday night at 9. That's not the way it works. So that's why you need to do that. I want to ask you we're going to deal with some of the specific stories that you cover. But before you do, there's something that's been that I've been thinking about, talking about, writing about recently, which I call 60s 2.0. And I just want to ask your take on this. And what it is that I find a lot of the values of the 60s, community, justice, honoring nature, slowing down, not accepting, the status quo, all of these things, alive again in millennials, in younger people for sure, and as you point out, as some of the characters who are the lead characters in some of your stories, every generation really. But I think that there are advantages this time. And among those advantages are, I'm going to just give you three. One is technology, that you can organize much more quickly and much more broadly with technology. We know that technology can be distorted and used to harm democracy, but it does give you advantages. Second, that the talent base is so much larger. Almost all the leaders in those years in the 60s were male. If it was a group of color, they were black males, Latino males, but it was almost always males. Nowadays,
and an awful lot of them are ministers.
That's true. But nowadays, it's men, it's women, it's people with all different gender orientations. It's global. I mean, what I sort of say is, on the one hand, the Chicago 8 was eight men, one black, no women. And now, two words, Greta Thunberg. I mean, the range of talent that we get to call on for this change is much larger. And finally, that to some extent, those who wanted change were a little bit on their own back then. There were some activists in the Bay Area, some activists in New York, you know, a few here and there. But now it seems to me there's a lot of boomers, there's a lot of millennials, there's just so much talent to draw on. And so my sense is that a lot of the values are resurgent, but the chances of success and sustainable success in changing society, I think, are greater. Your thoughts?
Well, I think everything you cited is definitely true. Certainly, the technology of social media has opened up all kinds of avenues of communication and organization that weren't available before. And certainly, as you point out, the talent pool has been expanded by having many more people active in social life and having opportunities that they didn't have before. So I think that's true. I think there is one disadvantage that mm-hmm. immediately jumps to my mind, and I mentioned it earlier, and that is the fact that the communications were dominated by three television networks meant that there was much more common knowledge of whatever it is those three networks covered. And if they focused on the civil rights movement, or they focused on poverty, or they focused on other problems such as immigration or guns or whatever, you had a lot wider knowledge base where people had a relatively common picture of what was going on. And I think society is much more fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is the political system has changed. The political system has become much more partisan. It was much easier back in the 60s to reach across party lines. Lyndon Johnson was able, as president, a Democratic president, was able to get the 1965 Voting Rights Act through the U.S. Senate because Everett McKinley Dirksen, the Republican minority leader in the Senate, agreed to work with the White House to break the filibuster mounted by Southern Democrats. And it's very hard to imagine that you could get that kind of bipartisan cooperation on a major issue in America today, absent the kind of political reforms we're talking about. So organizing, moving at the local level, which is what you and I are talking about and what I think the Democracy Rebellion is about and what its trademark is, which is moving city by city, state by state, rather than trying to deal with these problems at the national level through the Congress and through the White House. That's true. But if you get to the point where you want to, I mean, look at what the Democrats tried to do with H.R. 1, which was an omnibus reform package with public funding of campaigns and disclosure of dark money and gerrymander reform and everything wrapped into one. They got practically 100% of the Democratic votes, and they either didn't get any or they got one Republican vote because the parties have decided to take a stand on this as parties. And I think that's extremely harmful. And it exists in a number of states. I mean, you're taking battle states like Wisconsin and North Carolina and Florida. They're very much partisan states. Fortunately, when you go to the grassroots, and this is another thing that I discovered, which was surprising to me and refreshing and encouraging, is that the reform movements themselves, when they're started at the grassroots, and work their way up, they tend to be transpartisan. You tend to find people from all parties. I mean, Libertarian Party, Green Party. I was out in Seattle covering a push for public funding, and you had Tea Party types from the Patriot Organization working with the League of Women Voters, which you don't imagine is going on if you're sitting in Washington or you're following the media talking about American politics. But I do think the sort of tribal politics in the official political establishment in Washington and in many state legislatures, and sadly in a few city and county governments, I think that is a real obstacle. Now, it may generate more grassroots reaction, sense of rebellion because people are upset by this. And you can say, well, that's a stimulus to action. And I do think that that some of Trump's actions certainly have been a stimulus to action. But it's kind of a negative way to go,
and it's
definitely a handicap. So, I think there have been some positive changes, but there's certainly some obstacles. But it's the obstacles that are, in part, generating the change. I think that the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court, which is coming up on its 10th anniversary this month, which basically opened the floodgates to unlimited corporate and billionaire spending and campaigns, was probably the principal trigger to the modern democracy rebellion. Mm-hmm. That's what really angered lots of people. And there were resolutions passed in state legislatures, very quickly in a number of states right after that. And there are movements now in 20 states that have called for Congress to reverse that and pass a constitutional amendment. So I think excessive changes in the wrong direction are certainly creating the rebellion.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask one question about this national-local tension, if you will. And I spoke with Lawrence Lessig recently about his latest book, They Don't Represent Us. And it's clear to me that you and Lawrence share a lot of ground about how democracy is broken and the need to fix it. And I'm sure you're aware, Lawrence feels we can't achieve what we need to do without a constitutional convention to propose reform amendments. And then there are others who feel, no, that's very frightening. Who knows what would happen? You'd let the genie out of the bottle. Do you have any thoughts about that? Because I'm sure, you're looking at how do we make these reforms happen?
Well, I think it's a very tempting idea, but it's potentially very risky. Nobody's ever held a constitutional convention. The Constitution itself is very vague about how it could operate. It basically would write its own rules if it were summoned. I mean, the Congress could summon it if enough states demanded it. There is a movement on the balance the federal budget side, mm-hmm. where more than 30 states have called for a constitutional convention to deal with that. Once a constitutional convention is called and assembles, it writes its own rules. It determines what issues it's going to deal with. There's nothing that says once it's called that it has to stick with the issue that was the trigger mm-hmm. for the constitutional convention. It can go in any direction. And if you look at who's well organized, I would be wary of a constitutional convention as a method for achieving the kinds of systemic electoral reforms, election law reforms we're talking about, gerrymandering, mm-hmm, money in mm-hmm. politics,
yep,
voters'
those.
Rights,
yep.
That kind of stuff. I would be, in all honesty, I would be worried that people who are very much opposed to some of those reforms would not only succeed in blocking them at a convention, or might succeed in blocking them, but might well succeed in getting other things such as a balanced budget amendment or all kinds of other things, rolling back minority rights, mm-hmm. rolling back LGBT.
Okay, so you're in that side.
I'm in that camp. When I look at the Democratic Party today, when I look at the group of people, well, certainly the centrists are very disorganized, and I think the left is disorganized, and the right is far better organized. I would be concerned that the right would run away with that kind of convention.
Okay.
And I don't think that's going to help the kind of reforms that people are talking about when they call for that convention.
Okay.
I do understand the impulse, and I understand that the pressure for the convention may force the political system to adjust. If Congress sees that coming, they may say, well, we don't want that. We'll pass the laws. We'll do the reforms you want. But that's a loaded pistol. I would be worried about where the gun barrel would point when it's fired.
Very good. That's been, he opened my eyes to sort of saying, but what if all it could do was propose amendments? Would that be so bad? But we'll let that go for now. Okay.
Well, you can't let it go because the Constitution, Article 5 of the Constitution, doesn't tell you any answer to that.
In other words, it doesn't spell out.
Yeah, I mean, how can anybody say what if it could only do what it was called for? Who can say that?
Uh-huh.
You can't read Article 5 of the Constitution and say that's what it says. Once the Constitution's convention is called, it could be like the one in Philadelphia. It can write its own rules.
Okay. Very good. So I just wanted to set that aside so we can talk just a little bit about a couple of the stories. So Washington State, which is the one you lead off with. They passed I-735, which was a it was to deal with unregulated campaign spending. And just to point out what the effect of Citizens United, and I hadn't seen these numbers in a while, and I, you know, I knew it was bad, but that when before Citizens United, 2009, $8 million in unregulated campaign spending by independent political groups. 2010, after the passage of Citizens United, $300 million. 2016, 6 years later, $1.45 billion in unregulated campaign spending by independent political groups. That's how it's grown, and expect it to only go further. So what did Washington State do, and how did they succeed?
Well, this is the other answer to the Constitutional Convention. The idea is that you get enough states like Washington State who decide to pass resolutions, get the public to vote yes or no on our corporation's people. Is money speech? And should there be a constitutional amendment which doesn't impose limits on money but gives Congress the power to write legislation which will set limits on the campaign spending and campaign donations? What people have to understand was the Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, on the Citizens United case in January 2010, wiped away a century-old ban on corporate contributions and campaigns.
Right,
believe
and let me
not,
just point out to people that what we talked about before when we said that there were moments in the past where citizen action was potent, the progressive era at the start of the 20th century was one of them, and this was one of the reforms they passed at that point, which was to ban corporate contributions.
The Tillman Act of 1907, almost nobody knows this,
right.
The Tillman Act of 1907 passed while we had Republicans, in the White House and dominating Congress, barred any corporate contributions to campaigns. So understand that stood as law until 2010. So many people do have a question: how can a Supreme Court come along and throw out something which has been there for more than a century, where lots of other Supreme Courts haven't done that? I mean, isn't the Supreme Court writing law at that point? That's one of the reasons why so many people are really upset by the Supreme Court decision. And in Washington State, what they decided to do was to put on the ballot the issue: should we have a new constitutional amendment that restores the power of Congress and the states to regulate campaign money? I mean, that was the basic issue. And secondary issues was, you know, in terms of other court decisions, was it correct, as the court said, that corporations have the same rights under the First Amendment as individuals? Or was that right only granted to human beings, people who breathe or bear babies or bleed, the three B's, as people say,
right.
Human beings? And is money, spending money in campaign, the same thing as free speech? Can you spend money freely? And if you've got $100 million or $100 billion, can you spend it as opposed to somebody who's only got $5 and no dollars? And is that fair, and is that free speech? So that's the challenge. And what they did was they say, we're going to go out, we're going to put that on the ballot, we're going to organize. And it's amazing what they did. They didn't even raise a hell of a lot of money to do it. Cindy Black, whom I met out there, was a volunteer. She'd been involved in a couple of other small campaigns, and she wound up by being the executive director, or the head of what they called WAMEND, Washington Amend the Constitution, and Fix Democracy First was another organization, and they began to gather signatures. They had to gather something like 320,000 signatures in order to put the issue on the ballot in the 2016 election. They succeeded in doing that, and they got a positive vote. And what's amazing, what's amazing to me was these individuals. I met out there not just Cindy Black, but a bunch of other people, including a woman named Linda Bach. Linda Bach is one of the most improbable-looking reformers you can imagine. She's short. She's quite chubby. She's infectious. She has this wonderful energy. And when I ran into her, she and Cindy Black and a bunch of other people were at the famous fish market,
right,
in Seattle during a September lunch break, and there were a whole lot of people picnicking and having lunch, and they were going around canvassing them. Linda Bach, this dynamo, had collected 21,000 signatures to put the issue on the ballot, and now she was going after votes. And I talked to her, and she said, I feel like I'm in the tradition of the American Revolution, that every signature I get is a check for the Constitution. She said, democracy, you have to fight for it. Otherwise, it'll slip right through your hands. And it's that kind of attitude. Come off the bench. We've got to fight for it. I'm a modern Paul Revere attitude.
Yeah.
That is just stunning and blew me away when there's a kind of very simple gut feeling from people like Linda Bach and lots of others that we've got to do it. We've been asking the politicians to fix things. We've been watching what's been going on. We can't stand it. Nobody else is going to do it. It's kind of a Bunker Hill mentality. It's very much a mentality of the Minutemen. We got to get our own flintlock rifles out and shoot, even if it's only one bullet at a time.
And just a couple of ways that one turned out, and then I want to talk about another couple of these quickly. 63% of Washington voters voted for I-735. I think that shocked folks. And the way Cindy Black talked about it is the question was, how do you fight the big money that's opposing you? The big money that wants big money to stay in control. And she said, we rely on person-to-person contact to overcome big money, and it worked. And it takes 34 states to force Congress to pass an amendment, and at this point, 20 states are on record. Washington is one of 20 states that have voiced their opposition to Citizens United.
Well, it actually takes 34 states to call an Amendment 5 constitutional convention. But if you get close to that, the assumption is that if you get that close, that Congress will go ahead and do it before there's a constitutional convention.
Right. I mean, now, let's talk about Connecticut, because this one is, you know, pushing Congress to do something. Connecticut actually changed things, and as we mentioned briefly earlier, it really has changed what is possible in the state of Connecticut.
I have to say, this was one of the most surprising stories that I covered. Now, we cover six stories in the Democracy Rebellion documentary that's coming on PBS. But we actually went around. I actually went around to 15 or more states. Like any good reporter, I drilled a bunch of dry holes. So everything doesn't work perfectly, and you don't find the perfect story and that kind of stuff. And not only that, I wanted real stories. I also wanted some stories where people hadn't just thought of a reform or just gotten the signatures or just voted in the reform. I wanted some stories where the reform had been enacted 6, 8, 10 years ago, so you could go say, well, did it make any difference? And boy, in Connecticut, it's made an enormous difference. They had some scandals in Connecticut. They had a governor who had to resign because he'd taken some kickback from contractors that had worked for the state, and he went to jail. And so it put people in the mood, including his Republican successor, in the mood for some kind of campaign finance reform in Connecticut, affecting Connecticut elections, not affecting federal elections, but Connecticut elections, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, state legislature, offices like that. And there was a lot of resistance. And believe it or not, the resistance came mainly from the Democrats, because the Democrats were better at raising money in Connecticut than the Republicans. And the Republicans actually have benefited. They were at a great disadvantage in the legislature. There are more Republicans in the legislature now than there were before. But also, there are three times as many blacks and Latinos and Asian Americans. There are twice as many women as there were before. The kind of people that can run for political office has changed amazingly. People from the inner city, poor people, middle-class people, professional people with modest salaries who could never have afforded to run before, they have to raise a bit of money from 300 of their local constituents, not from outsiders, not from big donors. Nobody can give more than $100 in Connecticut once they get into this system. They have to raise some money to show that they're actually a viable candidate. And after that, they get a subsidy, and no more money gets raised privately. And then they go battle it out. And what's been amazing, nobody knew if it would work.
Right. Nobody knew how many people would be willing to do it.
Right. That was a big question. And now through 5, 6 election cycles, 80% of the people who run for state legislature take public funding of campaigns. It's kind of a bad mark if you don't. I mean, the Connecticut voters have come to sort of expect that. It's the good housekeeping seal of approval. And running for governor in 2014 and state office, everybody took it. This last election in 2018, there were two millionaires who were running for governor, and they turned it down. But the one who won immediately turned around and said he backed the system, and he was going to keep it going and that kind of stuff. So it is really embedded. It's changed the nature of power. Ordinary people have more power. Lobbyists have much less power. The agenda of the legislature is different. The kinds of legislation they've been able to pass, who heads the committees, who has the ranking posts. I mean, it has really changed the landscape and the picture of how politics operate in Connecticut. It's really an amazing reform, and it really has put the big donors on the sidelines in Connecticut state elections. Now, if you go to fighting for the U.S. Senate, fighting for the presidency, fighting for congressional seats, it doesn't cover those, and the politics there are different.
Right. And let me just say a couple of things. One of the interviewees in your documentary says, after this passage, relationships still matter. That is to say, you know, there's still lobbyists. There's still people, you know, building on the relationships. But he says, but they don't matter because of the check in the breast pocket anymore. They matter. And you point out that bills pass that would have been very unlikely to pass if big money funded candidates. Some of the soft drink law, I believe, passed, and some gun control.
Connecticut, after the Sandy Hook shooting, now the Sandy Hook did take place in Connecticut, so you can say that was part of it. But people I talked to said that the kind of tough legislation they passed, background checks, bans on AR-15s, bans on multiple magazines, that kind of stuff, that it would not have passed. They might have passed something, but it would have been much weaker legislation if the NRA and other gun lobbies had been able to finance campaigns. So I think that, you know, there's stuff on school lunch, there's healthcare stuff, there's inner city funding for retraining and education, that kind of stuff. A lot of materials, a lot of pieces of legislation that people tell me would not have passed under the old system.
Okay, let me just tell people the other stories that are covered. In North Carolina, you deal with voter suppression and the Moral Monday movement, Reverend William Barber and so on. In Florida, you deal with gerrymandering, which is something which is attempting to be dealt with in a lot of states.
But theirs is unusual because it's the only thing, it's the only state that says explicitly you cannot gerrymander with the intent to favor one party over the other.
That's law.
No
in the
other state,
of
the federal
in
constitution,
the
nobody goes that far. It's a really daring reform.
Yep. And let me see the other. South Dakota. South Dakota went for sort of the whole package or a significant package limiting campaign contributions. Yeah, the anti-corruption, which limits campaign contributions, greater exposure of funders, and these $100 democracy vouchers for public funding. And it won with 52% of the vote. But then the legislature repealed it, which struck me as appalling that could even happen. But these are the stories, and these are the characters, and this is the movement that you talk about in the documentary, which airs on PBS. In some places, it's already begun, it begins next week, others the week after. The website is reclaimtheamericandream.org. One word, reclaimtheamericandream.org. And you can go there, look for the drop-down menu that says videos, and in that one, look for PBS air dates, and you can find out when it will play in your city. The documentary is called The Democracy Rebellion, and for this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and transcripts and so on, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to my website, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. All one word, a world that just might work. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 issues that flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcast, iTunes, and most podcast sites. You can find years of podcasts there. That's archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G. Lee and Mark Maxwell and Teddy Robinson in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. Share the good news. Share the movement. Share what's possible. And finally, thank you, Hedrick Smith. Keep up your good work.
Terrence, I'll keep whacking at it, and I'm sure you will too. And I hope people, this lifts people's spirits legitimately. This is not Pollyanna reporting. This is hard-nosed reporting. As you pointed out, the people won in South Dakota. They got slapped down. But the nice thing is they're back fighting again.